small and white in the shadowed room, felt my fingers touch its cold face, felt my thumb pop open the silver catch. Now the brass pendulum was right at my fingertips, swinging to and fro with its ghastly tock-tocking. I was almost afraid to touch the thing. I took a deep breath and grabbed the pulsing pendulum. Its inertia made it squirm heavily in my hand for a moment, like a goldfish suddenly seized, like the telltale heart before it fell still. I felt round the back of the weighted brass. Something was fastened there, something taped behind it. A tiny packet. I pulled at it with my fingers, felt it come free and drop into my hand. Even as I withdrew my fingers from the clock's internal organs, I guessed what I was about to see. And I was right. There in my palm lay a little glassine envelope, inside which, clearly visible, was a penny black postage stamp. A penny black with a hole in its centre, such as might have been produced by the bill of a dead jacksnipe. What was there about it that had frightened Father so? I fished the stamp out for a better look. In the first place, there was Queen Victoria with a hole in her head. Unpatriotic, perhaps, but hardly enough to shake a grown man to his roots. No, there must be more. What was it that set this stamp apart from any other of its kind? After all, hadn't the things been printed by the tens of millions and all of them alike? Or were they? I thought of the time that Father, in the interest of broadening our outlook, had suddenly announced that Wednesday evenings would henceforth be given over to a series of compulsory lectures, delivered by him, on various aspects of British government. Series A, as he called it, was to be, predictably enough, on the topic, The History of the Penny Post. Daffy Feely and I had all brought notebooks to the drawing room and pretended to take notes while passing scraps of paper back and forth with scribbled messages to one another such as stamp out lectures and let's lick boredom. Postage stamps, Father had explained, were printed in sheets of 240, 20 horizontal rows of 12, which was easy enough for me to remember, since 20 is the atomic number for calcium and 12 the number for magnesium. All I had to do was think of CAMG. Each stamp on the sheet carried a unique two-letter identifier, beginning with AA on the upper left stamp and progressing alphabetically from left to right until TL was reached at the right end of the 20th, or bottom row. This scheme, Father told us, had been implemented by the post office to prevent forgeries, although it was not perfectly clear how this was to work. There had been rampant paranoia, he said, that dens of forgers would be toiling away day and night from Land's End to John O'Groats, producing copies to bilk Her Victorian Majesty out of a penny per time. I looked closely at the stamp in my hand. At the bottom, below Queen Victoria's head, was written its value, one penny. To the left of these words was the letter B, to their right, the letter H. It looked like this, B, one penny, H. B.H. The stamp had come from the second row on the printed sheet, eighth column to the right. 2-8. Was that significant? Aside from the fact that 28 was the atomic number for nickel, I could think of nothing. And then I saw it. It wasn't a number at all. It was a word. Bone penny. Not just bone penny, but bone penny H. Horace Bone Penny. Impaled on the jacksnipe's bill, yes, Father's schoolboy nickname had been Jacko. The stamp had served as calling card and death threat, a threat that Father had taken in and understood at first glance. The bird's bill had pierced the Queen's head, but left the name of its sender in clear view for anyone who had the eyes to see. Horace Bonepenny. The late Horace Bonepenny. I returned the stamp to its hiding place. At the top of the hill, a rotted wooden post, all that remained of an 18th-century gibbet, pointed two fingers in opposing directions. I could reach Hindley, I knew, by either taking the road to Doddingsley or by following a somewhat longer, less-travelled road that would take me through the village of St. Elfrida's. The former would get me there more quickly. The latter, being more sparsely travelled, would offer less risk of being spotted in case someone reported me missing. Ha ha ha, I said with vast irony. Who could care enough? Still, I took the road to the right and pointed Gladys towards St. Elfrida's. It was downhill all the way, and I made good speed. When I backpedaled, the Sturmey Archer three-speed hub on Gladys's rear wheel gave off a noise like a den of enraged, venom-dripping rattlesnakes. I pretended they were right there behind me, striking at my heels. It was glorious. I hadn't felt in such fine form since the day I first produced, by successive extraction and evaporation, a synthetic curare from the bog arum in the vicar's lily pond. I put my feet up on the handlebars and gave Gladys her head. As we shot down the dusty hill, I yodeled a song into the wind. They call her the lass with the delicate air. Chapter 13. At the bottom of Oakshot Hill, I suddenly thought of Father and sadness came creeping back. Did they honestly believe he had murdered Horace Bonepenny? And if so, how? If Father had murdered him beneath my bedroom window, the deed had been done in utter silence. I could hardly imagine Father killing someone without raising his voice. But before I could speculate further, the road levelled out before twisting off to Coatsmore and to Doddingsley Magna. In the shade of an ancient oak was a bus stop bench, upon which sat a familiar figure, an ancient gnome in plus fours, looking like a George Bernard Shaw who had shrunk in the wash. He sat there so placidly, his feet dangling 4 inches above the ground, that he might have been born on the bench and lived there all his life. It was Maximilian Brock, one of our Buckshaw neighbours, and I prayed he hadn't seen me. It was whispered in Bishop's Lacey that Max, retired from the world of music, was now earning a secret living by writing, under feminine pseudonyms, such as Lala Dupree, scandalous stories for American magazines with titles like Confidential Confessions and Red Hot Romances. Because of the way he pried into the affairs of everyone he met, then spun what he was told in confidence into news sellers' gold, Max was called, at least behind his back, the village pump. But as Feely's one-time piano teacher, he was someone whom I could not politely ignore. I pulled off into the shallow ditch, pretending I hadn't seen him as I fiddled with Gladys's chain. With any luck, he'd keep looking the other way and I could hide out behind the hedge until he was gone.
Flavia! Haru, mon vieux!
Curses! I'd been spotted. To ignore a haru from Maximilian, even one from a bus stop bench, was to ignore the 11th commandment. I pretended I had just noticed him and laid on a bogus grin as I wheeled Gladys towards him through the weeds. Maximilian had lived for many years in the Channel Islands, where he had been pianist with the Alderney Symphony, a position, he said, which required a great deal of patience and a good supply of detective novels. On Alderney, it was only necessary, or so he had told me once while chatting about crime at St. Tancred's annual flower show, in order to bring down the full power of the law, to stand in the middle of the town square and cry, "Haru, haru, mon prince, on me fait tort." This was called the hue and cry, and meant, in essence, "Attention, my prince, someone is taunting me," or, in other words, committing a crime against me.
"And how are you, my little pelican?"
Max asked, canting his head like a magpie awaiting a crumb of response even before it was offered. "I'm all right," I said warily, remembering that Daffy had once told me that Max was like one of those spiders that paralysed you with a bite and didn't quit until he had sucked the last drop of juice from your life and from the life of your family.
"And your father, the good colonel?"
"He's keeping busy, what with one thing and another," I said. I felt my heart give a flip-flop in my breast.
"That Miss Ophelia now?" he asked. "Is she still painting her face like Jezebel and admiring herself in the tea service?"
This was too close to home, even for me. It was none of his business, but I knew that Maximilian could fly into a towering rage at the drop of a hat. Feely sometimes referred to him behind his back as Rumpelstiltskin and Daffy as Alexander Pope, or lower. Still, I had found Maximilian, in spite of his repellent habits, and perhaps because of our similarity in stature, occasionally to be an interesting and informative conversationalist, just so long as you didn't mistake his diminutive size for weakness.
"She's very well, thank you,"
I said. Her complexion was quite lovely this morning. I did not add maddeningly.
Max, I asked, before he could wedge in another question, do you think I could ever learn to play that little toccata by Paradisi?
No, he said, without an instant's hesitation. Your hands are not the hands of a great artist. They're the hands of a poisoner.
I grinned. This was our little joke, and it was obvious that he had not yet learned of the murder at Buckshaw.
And the other one? He asked. Daphne, the slow sister.
Slow was a reference to Daphne's prowess, or lack of it, at the piano. An endless painful quest to place unwilling fingers upon keys that seemed to shy away from her touch. Daphne's battle with the instrument was one of the hen pitted against the fox, a losing battle that always ended in tears. And yet, because Father insisted upon it, the war went on. One day, when I found her sobbing on the bench with her head on the closed piano lid, I had whispered, "Give it up, Daph," and she had flown at me like a fighting cock. I had even tried encouragement. Whenever I heard her at the Broadwood, I would drift into the drawing-room, lean against the piano, and gaze off into the distance as if her playing had enchanted me. Usually she ignored me, but once when I said, "What a lovely piece that is. What's it called?" she had almost slammed the lid on my fingers. "The scale of G major," she had shrieked and fled the room. Buckshaw was not an easy place in which to live.
"She's well," I said, "reading Dickens like Billy Ho. Can't get a word out of her."
"Ah," Maximilian said, "dear old Dickens." He didn't seem to be able to think of anything further on that topic, and I dived into the momentary silence.
"Max," I said, "you're a man of the world." At this he preened himself and puffed up to whatever little height he could muster.
"Not just a man of the world, a boulevardier," he said.
"Exactly," I said, wondering what the word meant.
"Have you ever visited Stavanger? It would save me looking it up in the atlas."
"What?
Stavanger in Norway?"
Snap! I almost shouted aloud. Horace Bonepenny had been in Norway. I took a deep breath to recover myself, hoping it would be mistaken for impatience.
"Of course in Norway," I said condescendingly. "Are there other Stavangers?"
For a moment I thought he was on to me. His eyes narrowed and I felt a chill as the thunderclouds of a Maximilian tantrum blew across the sun. But then he gave a tiny giggle, like spring water gurgling into a glass.
"Stavanger is the first stepping stone on the road to hell, which is a railway station," he said. "I travelled over it to Trondheim and then on to hell, which, believe it or not, is a very small village in Norway, from which tourists often dispatch picture postcards to their friends with the message, 'Wish you were here,' and where I performed Grieg's piano concerto in A minor. Grieg, incidentally, was as much a Scot as a Norwegian. Grandfather from Aberdeen left in disgust after Culloden. Must have had second thoughts, though, when he realized he'd done no more than trade the fairs for the fjords. Trondheim was a great success, I must say. Critics kind, public polite. But those people, they never understand their own music, you know. Played Scarlatti as well, to bring a glimpse of Italian sunshine to those snowy northern climes. Still, at the intermission, I happened to hear a commercial traveller from Dublin whispering to a friend, 'It's all Greek to me, Thor.' I smiled dutifully, although I had heard this ancient jest about 45 times before. That was in the old days, of course, before the war.
Stavanger?
Yes, of course, I've been there.
But why do you ask?
How did you get there?
By ship?
Horace Bonepenny had been alive in Stavanger, and now he was dead in England, and I wanted to know where he had been in between.
Of course, by ship. You're not thinking of running away from home, are you, Flavia?
We were having a discussion, actually a row, about it last night at supper. This was one of the ways to optimize a lie, shovel on the old frankness. Ophelia thought one would embark from London. Father insisted it was Hull. Daphne voted for Scarborough, but only because Anne Bronte is buried there.
Newcastle upon Tyne, Maximilian said.
Actually, it's Newcastle upon Tyne.
There was a rumble in the distance as the Coatsmore bus approached, waddling along the lane between the hedgerows like a chicken walking a tightrope. It stopped in front of the bench, wheezing heavily as it subsided from the effort of its hard life among the hills. The door swung open with an iron groan.
"Annie, mon vieux," Maximilian said. "How fares the transportation industry?"
"Bored," Ernie said, looking straight ahead through the windscreen. If he caught the joke, he chose to ignore it.
"No ride today, Ernie. Just using your bench to rest my kidneys."
"Benches are for the sore use of travellers awaiting a coach. It's in the rule book, Max. You know that as well as I do."
"Indeed I do, Ernie. Thank you for reminding me."
Max slid off the bench and dropped to the ground.
"Cheerio, then," he said, and tipping his hat, he set off along the road like Charlie Chaplin.
The door of the bus squealed shut as Ernie engaged the juddering gears, and the coach whined into reluctant forward motion. And so we all went our separate ways. Ernie and his bus to Coatsmore, Max to his cottage, Gladys and I resuming our ride to Hindley. The police station in Hindley was housed in a building that had once been a coaching inn. Uncomfortably hemmed in between a small park and a cinema, its half-timbered front jutted beetle-brow out over the street, the blue lamp suspended from its overhang. A cinder-block addition, painted a nondescript brown, adhered to the side of the building like cow muck to a passing railway carriage. This, I suspected, was where the cells were located. Leaving Gladys to graze in a bicycle stand that was more than half full of official-looking black rallies, I went up the worn steps and in the front door. A uniformed sergeant sat at a desk shuffling bits of paper and scratching his sparse hair with the sharpened end of a pencil. I smiled and walked on past.
"Hold on, hold on," he rumbled.
"Where do you think you're going, miss?" he asked. It seems to be a trait of policemen to speak in questions. I smiled as if I hadn't understood and moved towards an open door, beyond which I could see a dark passageway. More quickly than I would have believed, the sergeant was on his feet and had seized me by the arm. I was nabbed. There was nothing else to do but burst into tears. I hated to do it, but it was the only tool I had with me. 10 minutes later, we were sipping cocoa in the station tea room, PC Glossop and I. He had told me that he had a girl just like me at home, which somehow I doubted, name of Elizabeth. "She's a great help to her poor mother, our Lizzie is," he said, "seeing as how Mrs. Glossop, the wife, that is, had a fall from a ladder in the apple orchard and broke a leg 2 weeks ago come Saturday." My first thought was that he had read too many issues of the Beano or the Dandy, that he was laying it on a bit thick for entertainment purposes. But the earnest look on his face and the furrowed brow quickly told me otherwise. This was the real Constable Glossop, and I would have to deal with him on his own terms. Accordingly, I began to sob again, and told him I had no mother, and that she had died in far-off Tibet in a mountaineering accident, and that I missed her dreadfully. "'Ear, ear, miss,' he said. "'Crying's not allowed in these ear premises.' "'Takes away from the natural dignity of the surroundings, so to speak. "'You best dry up now, for I have to toss you in the clink.' "'I managed a pale smile, which he returned with interest. "'Several detectives had slipped in for tea and a bun during my performance, "'each one of them giving me a silent thumbs-up smile. "'At least they hadn't asked any questions. "'May I see my father, please?' I asked. "'His name is Colonel Deluce, and I believe you're holding him here.' Constable Glossop's face went suddenly blank, and I saw that I had played my hand too quickly, that I was now up against officialdom. "'Wait here,' he said, and stepped out into a narrow passageway at the end of which there appeared to be a wall of black steel bars. As soon as he was gone, I had a quick look at my surroundings. I was in a dismal little room with sticks of furniture so shabby that they might have been bought directly off the tailgate of a peddler's cart— their legs chipped and dented as if they had suffered a century of kicks in the shin from government regulation boots. In a vain attempt to cheer things up, a tiny wooden cupboard had been painted apple green, but the sink was a rust-stained relic that might have been on loan from Wormwood Scrubs. Cracked cups and crazed saucers stood sadly cheek by jowl on a draining board, and I noticed for the first time that the mullions of the window were, in fact, iron bars only half-heartedly disguised. The whole place had an odd, sharp odour that I had noticed when I first came in. It smelt as if a jar of gentleman's relish, forgotten years ago at the back of a drawer, had gone off. Snatches of a song from the Pirates of Penzance flashed into my mind. "A policeman's lot is not a happy one," the doily cart opera company had sung on the wireless, and, as usual, Gilbert and Sullivan were right. Suddenly I found myself thinking about leaving. Oh, this whole mission was foolhardy, no more than an impulse to save Father, something thrown up from the prehistoric part of my brain. "Just get up and walk to the door," I said to myself. "No one will even notice you've gone." I listened for a moment, cocking my head like Maximilian to turn up my already acute hearing. Somewhere in the distance, bass voices buzzed like bees in a far-off hive. I slid my feet slowly, one in front of the other, like some sensuous senorita doing the tango, and stopped abruptly at the door. From where I stood, I could see only one corner of the sergeant's desk outside in the hallway, and, mercifully, there was no official elbow resting upon it. I ventured a peep. The corridor was empty, and I tangoed unhindered all the way to the door and stepped outside into the daylight. Even though I was not a prisoner, my sense of escape was immense. I strolled casually over to the bicycle stand. 10 seconds more and I'd be on my way. And then, as if someone had thrown a pail of ice water into my face, I froze in shock. Gladys was gone! I almost screamed it aloud! There rested all the official bicycles with their officious little lamps and government-issued carriers, but Gladys was gone. I looked this way and that, and somehow, frighteningly, the street seemed suddenly different now that I was on foot. Which way was home? Which way to the open road? As if I hadn't problems enough, there was a storm coming. Black clouds were boiling in the western sky, while those scudding directly overhead were already unpleasantly purple and bruised. Fear filled me, and then anger. How could I have been so stupid as to leave Gladys unlocked in a strange place? Oh, how would I get home? What was to become of poor Flavia? Feely had once told me never to look vulnerable in unfamiliar surroundings, but how, I found myself wondering, does one actually go about doing that? That was what I was thinking about when a heavy hand fell onto my shoulder and a voice said, "I think you'd better come with me." It was Inspector Hewitt. "That would be highly irregular," the inspector said. "Most improper." We were sitting in his office, a long, narrow room that had been the saloon bar of this one-time coaching inn. It was impressively neat, a room that needed only a potted aspidistra and a piano. A file cabinet and a desk of quite ordinary design, a chair, a telephone, and a small bookshelf, atop which was a framed photograph of a woman in a camel hair coat perching on the rail of a quaint stone bridge. Somehow I had expected more. "Your father is being detained here until we are in receipt of certain information. At that time he will likely be taken elsewhere, a place which I'm not at liberty to disclose. I'm sorry, Flavia, but seeing him is out of the question."
"Is he under arrest?" I asked.
"I'm afraid so," he answered.
"But why?"
This was a bad question, and I knew it as soon as it was out of my mouth. He was looking at me as if I were a child. "Look, Flavia," he said, "I know you're upset. That's understandable. You didn't have a chance to see your father before. Well, you were away from Buckshaw when we brought him here. These things are always very difficult for a police officer, you know, but you must understand that there are sometimes things which I would very much like to do as a friend, but which, as a representative of His Majesty, I am forbidden to do."
"I know," I said. "King George the VI is not a frivolous man."
Inspector Hewitt looked at me sadly. He got up from his desk and went to the window where he stood looking out at the gathering clouds, his hands clasped behind his back. "No," he said at last, "King George is not a frivolous man." Then suddenly I had an idea. Like the proverbial bolt of lightning, everything fell into place as smoothly as one of those backward cinema films in which the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle jump each into its own proper place, completing itself before your very eyes.
"May I be frank with you, Inspector?" I asked.
Of course, he said, please do.
The body at Buckshaw was that of a man who arrived in Bishop's Lacey on Friday after a journey from Stavanger in Norway. You must release father at once, Inspector, because, you see, he didn't do it. Although he was a little taken aback, the inspector recovered quickly and gave me an indulgent smile.
He didn't?
No, I said. I did. I killed Horace Bonepenny. Chapter 14. It was absolutely perfect. There was no one who could prove otherwise. I had been awakened in the night, I would claim, by a peculiar sound outside the house. I had gone downstairs and then into the garden, where I had been put upon by a prowler. A burglar, perhaps, bent on stealing father's stamps. After a brief struggle, I had overpowered him. Hold on, Flav. That last bit seemed a little far-fetched. Horace Bonepenny was more than 6 feet tall and could have strangled me between his thumb and forefinger. No, we had struggled and he had died. A dicky heart, perhaps, the result of some long-forgotten childhood illness. Rheumatic fever, let's say. Yes, that was it. Delayed congestive heart failure. Like Beth in Little Women. I sent up a silent prayer to St. Tancred to work a miracle. Please, dear St. Tancred, let Bonepenny's autopsy confirm my fib. I killed Horace Bonepenny, I repeated, as if saying it twice would make it seem more credible. Inspector Hewitt drew in a deep breath and let it out through his nose.
Tell me about it, he said.
I heard a noise in the night. I went out into the garden. Someone jumped out at me from the shadows.
Hold on, he said. What part of the shadows?
The shadows behind the potting shed. I was struggling to get free when there was a sudden gurgle in his throat, almost as if he had suffered congestive heart failure due to a bout of rheumatic fever he suffered as a child. Or something like that.
I see, Inspector Hewitt said. And what did you do then?
I went back into the house and fetched Dogger. The rest, I believe, you know. But wait. I knew that Dogger had not told him about our joint eavesdropping on Father's quarrel with Horace Bonepenny. Still, it was unlikely that Dogger would tell the inspector I had awakened him at 4 in the morning without mentioning the fact that I had killed the man. Or was it? I needed time to think this through.
Struggling with an attacker is hardly murder, the inspector said.
No, I said, but I haven't told you everything. I riffled at lightning speed through my mental index cards. Poisons unknown to science, too slow. Fatal hypnotism, ditto. The secret and forbidden blows of jiu-jitsu. Unlikely, too obscure to explain. Suddenly, it began to dawn on me that martyrdom required real inventive genius. A glib tongue was not enough. I'm ashamed to, I added. When in doubt, I thought, fall back on feelings. I was proud of myself for having thought of this. The inspector said. Let's leave it for now. Did you tell Dogger you had killed this prowler?
No, I don't believe I did. I was too upset by it all, you see.
Did you tell him later?
No, I didn't think his nerves were up to it.
Well, this is all very interesting, Inspector Hewitt said. But the details seem a bit sparse.
I knew that I was standing at the edge of a precipice. One step more and there would be no turning back. There's more, I said, but...
But?
I'm not saying another word until you let me speak to Father.
Inspector Hewitt seemed to be trying to swallow something that wouldn't go down. He opened his mouth as if some obstruction had suddenly materialized in his throat, then closed it again. He gulped. And then did something that I had to admire, something I made a mental note to add to my own bag of tricks. He grabbed for his pocket handkerchief and transformed his astonishment into a sneeze.
Privately, I added.
The inspector blew his nose loudly and went back to the window, where he stood gazing out at nothing in particular, his hands again behind his back. I was beginning to learn that this meant he was thinking deeply. All right. He said abruptly. Come along.
I jumped up eagerly from my chair and followed him. At the door, he barred the way into the corridor with one arm and turned, his other hand floating down as gently as a feather onto my shoulder.
I'm about to do something which I may have grave cause to regret, he said. I'm risking my career. Don't let me down, Flavia. Please, don't let me down.
Flavia, father said.
I could tell he was amazed to see me there, and then he spoiled it by adding,
Take this child away, Inspector. I beg of you, remove her.
He turned away from me and faced towards the wall. Although the door of the room had been painted over with yellowish cream enamel, it was obvious that it was clad with steel. When the inspector had unlocked it, I had seen that the chamber itself was little more than a small office with a fold-down cot and a surprisingly clean sink. Mercifully, they had not put father into one of the barred cages I'd glimpsed earlier. Inspector Hewitt gave me a curt nod as if to say, "It's up to you," then stepped outside and closed the door as quietly as possible. There was no sound of a key turning in the lock or of a bolt shooting home, although a bright flash outside and the sudden crash of thunder might well have masked the sound. Father must have thought that I'd gone out with the inspector, because he gave a nervous start as he turned around and saw that I was still there.
"Go home, Flavia," he said.
Although he stood stiffly and perfectly erect, his voice was old and tired. I could see that he was trying to play the stolid English gentleman, fearless in the face of danger, and I realized with a pang that I loved him and hated him for it at the same time. "It's raining," I said, pointing to the window. The clouds had torn themselves apart as they had done earlier at the folly, and the rain was falling heavily once again, the fat drops clearly audible as they bounced like shot from the ledge outside the window. In a tree across the road, a solitary rook shook itself out like a wet umbrella. "I can't go home until it stops, and someone's pinched Gladys."
"Gladys?" he said, his eyes like those of an extinct sea creature swimming up from unknown depths.
"My bicycle," I told him. He nodded absently, and I knew he hadn't heard me.
"Who brought you here?" father asked. "Him?" He jerked his thumb towards the door to indicate Inspector Hewitt.
"I came by myself."
"By yourself? From Buckshaw?"
"Yes," I said.
This seemed to be more than he could grasp, and he turned back to the window. I couldn't help noticing that he took up the same stance as Inspector Hewitt, with his hands clasped behind his back. "By yourself? From Buckshaw?" he said at last, as if he had just worked it out.
"Yes."
"And Daphne and Ophelia?"
"They are both well," I assured him. "Missing you terribly, of course, but they're looking after things until you come home." "If I tell a lie, my mother will die." That was what the little girls sometimes chanted as they skipped rope in the churchyard. Well, my mother was already dead, wasn't she? So what harm could it possibly do? And who knows, because of it, I might even have a credit in heaven.
"Come home?" father said at last, as something like a sigh escaped him. "That might not be for some time. No, that might not be for quite some time."
On the wall, beside a barred window, was pasted up a calendar from a Hindley greengrocer, bearing a picture of King George and Queen Elizabeth, each hermetically sealed in his or her own private bubble, and dressed in a way that made me think the photographer had caught them by chance on the way to a costume ball at the castle of some Bavarian princeling. Father gave the calendar a furtive glance and began pacing restlessly back and forth in the little room, studiously avoiding my gaze. He seemed to have forgotten I was there, and had now begun making irregular little humming noises punctuated with an occasional indignant sniff as if he were defending himself before an invisible tribunal.
"I confess just now," I said.
"Yes, yes," father said, and went on pacing and mumbling to himself. "I told Inspector Hewitt that I killed Horace Bonepenny." Father came to as dead a stop as if he had run onto a sword. He turned and fixed me with that dreaded blue stare which was so often his weapon of choice when dealing with his daughters.
"What do you know about Horace Bonepenny?" he asked in a chill tone.
"Quite a lot, actually," I said. Then, surprisingly, the fight went out of him all at once, just like that.
One moment his cheeks were puffed out like the face of the winds that blow across medieval maps, and the next they were as hollow as a horse trader's. He sat down on the edge of the bunk, spreading out the fingers of one hand to steady himself.
"I overheard your disagreement in the study," I said. "I'm sorry if I eavesdropped. I didn't mean to, but I heard voices in the night and came downstairs. I know that he tried to blackmail you. I heard the quarrel. That's why I told Inspector Hewitt that I killed him."
This time it filtered through to Father.
"Killed him?" he asked. "What do you mean, killed him?"
"I didn't want them to know it was you," I said.
"Me?" Father said, rocketing up off the bed. "Good Lord, whatever makes you think I killed the man?"
"It's all right," I said. "He most likely deserved it. I'll never tell anyone, I promise."
With my right hand, I crossed my heart and hoped to die, and Father stared at me as if I were some monstrous wet creature that had just flopped out of a painting by Hieronymus Bosch.
"Flavia," he said, "please understand this. Much as I should have liked to, I did not kill Horace Bonepenny."
"You didn't?"
I could scarcely believe it. I had already come to the conclusion that Father must have committed murder, and I could see that it was going to be hard cheese admitting I was wrong. Still, I remembered that Feely had once told me that confession was good for the soul. This while she had my arm bent behind my back, trying to force me to tell her what I had done with her diary.
"I overheard what you said about killing your housemaster, Mr. Twining. I went to the library and looked it up in the newspaper archives. I talked to Miss Mountjoy. She's Mr. Twining's niece. She remembered the names Jacko and Horace Bonepenny from the inquest. I know that he stayed at the 13 Drakes and that he brought a dead jacksnipe from Norway hidden in a pie."
Father shook his head slowly and sadly from side to side, not in admiration of my detective skills, but like an old bear that has been shot yet refuses to lie down.
"It's true," he said. "But do you really believe your father capable of cold-blooded murder?"
When I thought about it for a moment, actually thought about it, I saw how foolish I had been. Why had I not realized this before? Cold-blooded murder was just one of the many things Father was incapable of.
"Well, no," I ventured.
"Flavia, look at me," he said.
But when I looked up and into his eyes, I saw, for an unnerving instant, my own eyes staring back at me and I had to look away.
"Horace Bonepenny was not particularly a decent man, but he did not deserve to die."
"No one deserves to die," Father said, his voice fading out like a distant broadcast on the shortwave, and I knew that he was no longer speaking only to me.
"There is already so much death in the world," he added.
He sat, looking at his hands, each thumb stroking the other, his fingers engaging like the cogs of an old clock. After a time, he said,
"What about Dogger?"
"He was there too," I admitted, "outside your study."
Father gave a groan.
"That is what I feared," he whispered. "That is what I feared more than anything."
And then, as the rain swept in sheets across the window pane, Father began to talk.
Chapter 15. At first, Father's unaccustomed words came slowly and hesitantly, jerking into reluctant motion like rusty freight cars on the railway. But then, picking up speed, they soon smoothed out into a steady flow.
"My father was not an easy man to like," he said. "He sent me away to boarding school when I was 11. I seldom saw him again. It's odd, you know. I never knew what interested him until someone at his funeral, one of the pallbearers, chanced to remark that his passion had been netsuge. I had to look it up in the dictionary."
"It's a small Japanese carving in ivory," I said. "It's in one of Austin Freeman's Dr. Thorndike stories."
Father ignored me and went on.
"Although Grayminster was no more than a few miles from Buckshaw, in those days it might just as well have been on the moon. We were fortunate indeed in our headmaster, Dr. Kissing,
a gentle soul who believed no harm could ever come to the boy who was administered daily doses of Latin, rugger, cricket, and history, and on the whole we were treated well. Like most, I was a solitary boy at first, keeping to my books and weeping in the hedgerows whenever I could get away on my own. Surely, I thought, I must be the saddest child in the world, that there must be something innately horrid about me to cause my father to cast me off so heartlessly. I believed that if I could discover what it was, there might be a chance of putting things right, of somehow making it up to him. At night in the dorm, I would tunnel under the blankets with an electric torch and examine my face in a stolen shaving mirror. I couldn't see anything particularly wrong, but then I was only a child and not really equipped to judge these things. But time went on, as time does, and I found myself being swept up into the life of the school. I was good at history, but quite hopeless when it came to the books of Euclid, which put me somewhere in the middle ranks, neither so proficient nor so stupid as to draw attention to myself. Mediocrity, I discovered, was the great camouflage, the great protective colouring. Those boys who did not fail, yet did not excel, were left alone, free of the demands of the master who might wish to groom them for glory, and of the school bully who might make them his scapegoat. That simple fact was the first great discovery of my life. It was in the fourth form, I think, that I finally began to take an interest in the things around me, and, like all boys of that age, I had an insatiable taste for mystification, so that when Mr. Twining, my house master, proposed the founding of a conjuring circle, I found myself suddenly ablaze with new enthusiasm. Mr. Twining was more kindly than adept, not a very polished performer, I must admit, but he carried off his tricks with such ebullience, such good-hearted enthusiasm, that it would have been churlish of us to withhold our noisy schoolboy applause. He taught us, in the evenings, to turn wine into water using no more than a handkerchief and a bit of coloured blotting paper, how to make a marked shilling vanish from a covered drinking glass before being extracted from Simpkin's ear. We learned the importance of patter, the conjurer's line of talk, as it were, and he drilled us in spectacular shuffles, which left the ace of hearts always at the bottom of the pack. It goes without saying that Mr. Twining was popular. Loved, might be a better word, although few of us at the time had seen enough of that emotion to recognize it for what it was. His greatest recognition came when the headmaster, Dr. Kissing, asked him to get up a conjuring show for Parents' Day, a happy scheme into which he threw himself wholeheartedly. Because of my prowess with an illusion called the Resurrection of Chang Fu, Mr. Twining was keen to have me perform it as the grand finale of the show. The stunt required two operators, and for that reason he allowed me to choose any assistant I wanted. That was how I came to know Horace Bonepenny. Horace had come to us from St. Cuthbert's after a fuss at that school about some missing money. Just a couple of pounds, I believe it was, although at the time it seemed a fortune. I felt sorry for him, I admit. I felt he had been misused, particularly when he confided to me that his father was the cruelest of men and had done unspeakable things in the name of discipline. I hope this is not too coarse for your ears, Flavia.
No, of course not, I said, pulling my chair closer. Oh, please go on.
Horace was an extraordinarily tall boy even then, with a shock of flaming red hair. His arms were so long in the school jacket that his wrists stuck out like bare twigs beyond the cuffs. Bony, the boys called him, and they ragged him without mercy about his appearance. To make matters worse, his fingers were impossibly long and thin and white, like the tentacles of an albino octopus, and he had that pale bleached skin one sometimes sees in redheads. It was whispered that his touch was poison. He played this up a bit, of course, snatching with pretended clumsiness at the jeering boys who danced round him always just out of reach. One evening, after a game of hare and hounds, he was resting at a stile, panting like a fox, when a small boy named Potts danced in on tiptoe and delivered him a stinging blow across the face. It was meant to be no more than a touch, like tagging the runner, but it soon turned into something else. When they saw that the fearful monster Bonepenny was stunned and his nose bleeding, the other boys began to pile on, and Boney was soon down, being pummeled, kicked, and savagely beaten. It was just then that I happened along. "Hold up," I shouted as loudly as I could, and to my amazement, the scuffle stopped at once. The boys began extricating themselves one by one from the tangle of arms and legs. There must have been something in my voice that made them obey instantly. Perhaps the fact that they had seen me perform mystifying tricks lent me some invisible air of authority. I don't know, but I do know that when I ordered them to get themselves back to Greyminster, they faded like a pack of wolves into the dusk. "Are you all right?" I asked Boney, helping him to his feet. Faintly tender, but only in one or two widely separated spots, like Carnforth's beef, he said, and we both laughed. Carnforth was the notorious Hindley butcher whose family had been supplying Greyminster with its boot-leather Sunday roasts of beef since the Napoleonic Wars. I could see that Boney was more badly beaten than he was willing to let on, but he put a brave face on it. I gave him my shoulder to lean upon and helped him hobble back to Greyminster. From that day on, Boney was my shadow. He adopted my enthusiasms, and in doing so seemed almost to become a different person. There were times, in fact, when I fancied he was becoming me, that here before me was the part of myself for which I had been searching in the midnight mirror. What I do know is that we were never in better form than when we were together. What one of us couldn't do, the other could accomplish with ease. Boney seemed to have been born with a fully formed mathematical ability, and he was soon unveiling for me the mysteries of geometry and trigonometry. He made a game of it, and we spent many a happy hour calculating upon whose study the clock tower of Anson House would fall when we toppled it with a gigantic steam lever of our own invention. Another time, we worked out by triangulation an ingenious series of tunnels, which at a given signal would collapse simultaneously, causing Greyminster and all its inhabitants to plunge into a Dantean abyss, where they would be attacked by the wasps, hornets, bees, and maggots with which we planned to stock the place.
"Wasps, hornets, bees, and maggots? Could this be Father speaking? I suddenly found myself listening to him with new respect."
"How this was to be achieved," he went on, "we never really thought through. But the upshot of it all was that while I was getting chummy with old Euclid and his books of propositions, Boney, with a bit of coaching, was turning out to be a natural conjurer. It was the fingers, of course. Those long white appendages seemed to have a life of their own, and it wasn't long before Boney had mastered completely the arts of prestidigitation. Various objects appeared and vanished at his fingertips with such fluid grace that even I, who knew perfectly well how each illusion was done, could scarcely believe my eyes. And as his conjuring skill grew, so did his sense of self-worth. With a bit of magic in hand, he became a new Boney, confident, smooth, and perhaps even brash. His voice changed too. Where yesterday he had sounded like a raucous schoolboy, he seemed now, suddenly, at least, when he was performing, to possess a voice-box of polished mahogany, a hypnotic professional voice which never failed to convince its hearers. The resurrection of Chang Fu worked like this. I decked myself out in an oversized silk kimono I had found at a church jumble sale, a beautiful blood-red thing covered with Chinese dragons and mystical markings. I plastered my face with yellow chalk and stretched a thin elastic round my head to pull my eyes up at the corners. A couple of sausage casings from Carnforth's, varnished and cut into long, curving fingernails, added a disgusting detail. All that was needed to complete my get-up was a bit of burnt cork, a few wisps of frayed string for a beard, and a frightful theatrical wig. I would call for a volunteer from the audience, a confederate, of course, who had been rehearsed beforehand. I would bring him on stage and explain, in a comic sing-song Mandarin voice, that I was about to kill him, to send him off to the land of the happy ancestors. This matter-of-fact announcement never failed to fetch a gasp from the audience, and before they could recover themselves, I would pull a pistol from the folds of my robe, point it at my confederate's heart, and pull the trigger. A starter's pistol can make a frightful din when it's fired indoors, and the thing would go off with the most dreadful bang. My assistant would clasp his chest, squeezing in his hand a concealed paper twist of ketchup, which would ooze out horribly between his fingers. Then he would look down at the mess on his chest and gape in disbelief. "Help me, Jacko!" he would shriek. "The trick's gone wrong! I'm shot!" and fall dead flat on his back. The audience would by now be sitting bolt upright in shock. Several would be on their feet, and a few in tears. I would hold up a hand to quiet them.
"Silence!"
I would hiss, fixing them with an awful stare.
"Ancestors, require silence!"
There might be a few titters of nervous laughter, but generally there was a shocked hush. I would fetch a rolled-up sheet from the shadows and drape it over my apparently dead assistant, leaving only his upturned face visible. Now the sheet was quite a remarkable object, one which I had manufactured in great secrecy. It was divided lengthwise into thirds by a pair of slender wooden dowels sewn into two narrow pockets that ran the length of the sheet and were, of course, invisible when the thing was rolled up. Squatting down and using my robe as cover, I would slip my assistant's shoes from his feet. This was easily done, since he had secretly loosened his laces just before I chose him from the audience, and stick them toes up on the end of the dowels. The shoes, you see, had been specially prepared by having a hole drilled up through each heel into which a penny nail could be inserted and pushed through to pierce the end of the dowel. The result was most convincing. A gaping corpse lying dead on the floor, its head sticking out at one end of the drape sheet and its upturned shoes at the other. If everything went according to plan, great red stains would by now have begun to seep through the sheet above the corpse's chest, and if not, I could always add a bit from a second twist of paper sewn into my sleeve. Now came the important part. I would call for the lights to be lowered.
"Honorable ancestors, require complete darkness."
And in the gloom I would set off a couple of flashes of magnesium paper. This had the effect of blinding the audience for a moment, just enough time for my assistant to arch his back and, as I adjusted the sheet, get his feet firmly on the floor in a squatting position. His shoes, of course, protruding from the bottom of the sheet, made it seem as if he were still lying perfectly horizontal. Now I would go into my oriental mumbo-jumbo, waving my hands about, summoning him back from the land of the dead. As I jabbered away and made up incantations, my assistant would very slowly begin to raise himself from a squat until he was standing upright, supporting the projecting dowels on his shoulders, his shoes sticking out at the far end of the sheet. What the audience saw, of course, was a sheet-draped body that rose straight up into the air and hung floating there 5 feet above the floor. Then I would beg the happy ancestors to restore him to the land of the living spirits. This would be done with many mystifying passes of my hands, after which I would set off a final flash of magnesium paper, and my assistant would throw off the sheet as he leapt into the air and landed on his feet. The sheet, with its nailed-on shoes and its sewn-in dowels, would be thrown aside in the darkness, and we would be left to take our bows amid a storm of thunderous applause. And because he wore black socks, no one ever seemed to notice that the dead man had lost his shoes. This was the resurrection of Chang Fu, and that was the way I planned to stage it for Parents' Day. Boney and I would sneak off to the washhouse with our gear, where I would drill him in the niceties of the illusion. But it soon became apparent that Boney was not the ideal confederate. In spite of his enthusiasm, he was simply too tall. His head and feet stuck out too far beyond my doctored sheet, and it was too late to fabricate a new one. And there was the inescapable fact that while Boney was a marvel with his hands, his body and limbs were still those of an awkward and ungainly schoolboy. His stalk-like knees would tremble when he was supposed to be levitating, and at one rehearsal he fell flat on his behind, bringing the whole illusion, sheet, shoes and all, down with a crash. I couldn't think what to do. Boney would be devastated if I chose another assistant. And yet it was too much to hope that he would master his role in the few days remaining before the performance. I was on the verge of despair. It was Boney who came up with the solution.
"Why not swap roles?"
he suggested after one particularly embarrassing collapse of our props.
"Let me have a go. I'll put on the old sorcerer's robe and you shall be the floater."
I have to admit it was brilliant. With his face of chalky yellow and his long, thin hands projecting from the sleeves of the red kimono, made even more ghastly by 3 inches of sausage-skin fingernails, Boney made as remarkable a figure as has ever stalked the stage. And because he was a natural mimic, he had no trouble in picking up the cracked, piping voice of an ancient mandarin. His Oriental double-talk was, if anything, better than my own, and those long, twiggy fingers waving in the air like stick insects were a sight not soon to be forgotten. The performance itself was brilliant. With the entire school and the visiting parents as onlookers, Boney put on a show that none of them will ever forget. He was, by turns, exotic and sinister. When he called me up from the audience as his assistant, even I shivered a little at this menacing figure who was beckoning from beyond the footlights. And when he fired the pistol and shot me in the chest, there was pandemonium. I had taken the precaution of warming up and watering down my reservoir of ketchup blood, and the resulting stain was all too horridly real. One of the parents, the father of Giddings Minor, had to be physically restrained by Mr. Twining, who had foreseen that some gullible onlooker might rush the stage. "Steady on, dear sir," Twining whispered in Mr. Giddings' ear. "It's simply an illusion. These boys have done it many a time before." Mr. Giddings was escorted reluctantly back to his seat, his face still burning red. Yet in spite of it, he was man enough to come up after the show and give both our hands a good cranking. After such a bath of gore at the death, my levitation at the resurrection was almost a letdown, if I may use the phrase, although it brought round after round of ringing applause from an audience of kind hearts who were relieved to see the hapless volunteer restored to life. At the end, we were made to come back for 7 curtain calls, although I knew perfectly well that at least 6 of them were for my partner. Boney soaked up the adulation like a parched sponge. An hour after the show, he was still shaking hands and being patted on the back by a tidal wave of admiring mothers and fathers who seemed to want only to touch him. Although when I threw my arm across his shoulders, he gave me rather an odd look. A look which suggested, for a fleeting instant, that he had never seen me before. In the days that followed, I saw that a transformation had come over him. Boney had become the confident conjurer, and I was now no more than his simple assistant. He began speaking to me in a new way and adopted a rather off-hand manner, as if his earlier timidity had never existed. I suppose I could say he dropped me. Well, that was how it seemed. I often saw him with an older boy, Bob Stanley, who was someone I had never much fancied. Stanley had one of those angular, square-jawed faces that photographs well but seems hard in real life. As he had done with me, Boney seemed to take on some of Stanley's traits, in much the same way a bit of blotting paper absorbs the handwriting from a letter. I know that it was at about this time that Boney began smoking and, I suspect, tippling a bit as well. One day, I realized with a bit of a shock that I no longer liked him. Something had changed inside Boney, or perhaps had crawled out. There were times when I caught him staring at me in the classroom when his eyes would seem to be at first the eyes of an aged mandarin, and then, as they regarded me, would become cold and reptilian. I began to feel as if, in some unknowable way, something had been stolen from me. But there was worse to come.
Father fell silent, and I waited for him to go on with his story, but instead he sat gazing out sightlessly into the falling rain. It seemed best to keep quiet and leave him to his thoughts, whatever those might be. But I knew that, as with Horace Bonepenny, something had changed between us. Here we were, Father and I, shut up in a plain little room, and for the first time in my life having something that might pass for a conversation. We were talking to one another almost like adults, almost like one human being to another, almost like father and daughter. And even though I couldn't think of anything to say, I felt myself wanting it to go on and on until the last star blinked out. I wished I could hug him, but I couldn't. For some time now I had been aware that there was something in the Deleuze character which discouraged any outward show of affection towards one another, any spoken statement of love. It was something in our blood. And so we sat, Father and I, primly, like 2 old women at a parish tea. It was not a perfect way to live one's life, but it would have to do. Chapter 16.
A flash of lightning bleached every trace of colour from the room, and with it came a deafening crack of thunder. We both of us flinched.
"The storm is directly overhead," Father said.
Nodding to reassure him that we were in it together, I looked about at my surroundings. The brightly lighted little cubicle, its naked bulb overhead, its steel door and its